Thank you for coming back after our first PG-13 to R-rated sermon last week for violence. I don't know if anybody else felt that. That was a rough one last week. I guess a lot of people weren't here last week. So Dan went through like one of the most violent sections of scripture, and it was difficult to hear all that violence. I'm joking, being serious at the same time. And so anyway, that was last week. First little attempt at humor this morning is a flop, but we'll see what happens. Thank you. So anyway, I'm stealing from Dan last week. We're going to keep track of some stuff on the board here. But before we do, I just have a little bit of an introductory thought. And so you may not know this, you probably don't know this, but next month there's going to be an animated Christmas movie that comes out in the theaters. And so the trivia on this, which I haven't researched to make sure it's true, is that this is the first animated feature to talk about a specific story from the Bible since the Prince of Egypt. So that's kind of a weird statistic, but that's been a long time. So the marketers, they're smart these days. They've probably always been smart, but what they did is they emailed all the pastors that they could possibly find, and they said, we're going to do an advanced screening of this so that you can know about it. So not yesterday, but the Saturday before, me and Asher, we went to this movie theater and sat down. And I was too cheap to buy him popcorn, but we sat there with the cheapest candy they had, and we sat there and we watched this movie called The Star. And it's okay, you know, for this big Hollywood thing. How much better is it going to be from Hollywood? And so we watched this movie. So what The Star is about is a story that hopefully is familiar to you. You have Joseph and you have Mary. Mary's pregnant, and they need to go to Bethlehem because of the census. You've heard this story before. We're going to talk about it more in December here at Crossway in case you're rusty on it. What the movie postulates and what it thinks about is it's kind of like going outside of Luke a little bit, but it theorizes what would have happened if they're taking this trip to Bethlehem and alongside of them are talking animals, cute talking animals. And so there's Bo. Bo's a talking donkey. There's Dave. He's a talking dove. And Ruth, who's a talking sheep. And so they're all traveling along. And what Joseph and Mary don't know is that there's all this danger that's going on along the way from Herod and these two, like, really mean and nasty and vicious dogs. And Bo and Dave and Ruth are shielding them from all this danger. And so Christmas almost never happens. Christmas almost never happens except for this dove and this sheep and this donkey. They save the day. And this week in a commentary, so this is how this relates to the sermon this morning. This week in a commentary, he referred to our passage this morning as a story about a lady who saves Christmas. And I started thinking about it, and I was like, yeah, that kind of fits. And so in the movie, these guys, they're saving Christmas. They're making sure that Jesus is born in the stable where he's supposed to. And in our story this morning, what happens in regards to saving Christmas? What this commentator was getting at is, there's a line of David that was promised, and that's what Sam just read about. And what that line leads up to is what we refer to as Christmas, the day that Jesus was born. And Jesus, according to the Old Testament, had to be born from the line of David. He had to be born from the line of David because if not, God has not come through on his promises. He's not a God who has things ordered. He's not a God that controls history. And if ever in the history, I don't think I'm overstating here, if ever in the history of time, it seemed like God was not a God who could keep his promises, it has to do with our story this morning. Christmas, I know this is dramatic, Christmas almost never happened. If you read this story, it comes within a hair's breadth. And so that's kind of the setup for what we're going to be talking about this morning. What we're going to see is that unfaithful people, we need a faithful God. We need a faithful God like this who's working and who's at work, whether we see him working or whether we don't see him working. Now, as we've gone through 1 and 2 Kings, as you read this on your own, there's some stories that you can kind of make sense of, and you can understand them kind of on a cursory reading, like you got 5 minutes here in devotions. But there's other stories that you have to do a little bit of work on to really track what's going on. And the authors, they make it a little bit difficult. Sometimes they'll call cities or areas by different names. And this morning, they call people by different names or different spellings, and so it can be confusing. And so what you've seen represented in a few different sermons is like we're going to wrestle through that up front. It's not going to be just totally easy and spoon-fed. It's good for us to, in the sermons, represent a little bit of the work that it takes to do this on our own. So if you're just reading the first part of 2 Kings chapter 11 without understanding who's who, it's going to be a little bit tricky. And it was tricky for me this week as I was working on it. So here's a little reminder of who's who, and I'm going to use a little bit of a cheat sheet myself. So what Sam read this morning, it was the Davidic covenant. And so that essentially says that the kingdom is going to forever come through the line of David. And what it's pointing towards is there's a Messiah to come. There's a Messiah to come, and he's going to come through the line of David. And so one of the things as you read the Old Testament, there's a lot of different things you're looking for. But of those many things, one of them is where are we at with that timeline? Where are we at with what's going on? Where are we at with that line of David? And so what I've done for you here is I've represented a little bit of what the family tree looks like. So a lot of you, you're probably aware of, so David, he had Solomon, and you follow the family tree down a little bit, and you get to Jehoshaphat. And then Jehoshaphat has a son, and his name is Jehoram. Jehoram has a son, his name is Ahaziah, and then he has a son named Joash. Now here's what's also important to note. All these people, they have brothers. So I'm going to do bro. I didn't do the research to try to see how clear the Bible is on how many brothers they have. But it's a family tree just like any others, and they have their brothers. And that's significant because if the lineage of David is going to continue on, it has to go through one of these guys. And so it's going to be significant if by chance, I'm just going to check so I don't tell you the wrong thing. If by chance, Jehoram, whenever he takes power, he kills off all of his siblings. That's important to know. So now the family line, if it's going to go through David, has to go through Jehoram. And if by chance, which actually happened, the Philistines and the Arabians, they come in and they take a whole bunch of people captive and kill a whole bunch of people, leaving only Ahaziah, that's significant as well. So the family tree now, and by the time we get to our passage this morning, Jehoshaphat has died. Now there's something else that's important to know for our story this morning, and that there's a marriage that has happened here, and Dan referred to it last week, so just so you know, this is a heart that shows that there's a marriage. And he was married to, I still don't know how to say this, even though I worked on it all week. Athaliah? All right, so they're married together. Now, there's an interesting bit of trivia about her. Does anybody know who her dad is? Do you remember that from last week? We've been talking about her dad for months. He's a bad guy. His wife was maybe even worse. She's the daughter of Ahab. And these are two different kingdoms. So this is the kingdom from the south, and this is the kingdom from the north, and they've united through this marriage, and there's a good chance they didn't actually love each other, and the heart's not appropriate. But we don't know for sure if this is Jezebel's daughter or not, but either way, if it's a stepmother or her mother, she's not a real nice lady either. And so these are some of the people that are important to be aware of. There's one more person I want to tell you about up front. Ahaziah, he has some brothers, but he also has a sister, and her name is Jehosheba. That might be how you say it. I'm not promising anything. Jehosheba, something like that. So this is a sister. So that's going to be important information for us in a little bit. So this is your cheat sheet this morning as we read through this passage. It's going to be my cheat sheet as well as to what's going on. And let's go back to this first verse that Sam read. And he left you with sort of a cliffhanger. He did that because I told him to, not because he was being mean or dramatic. So 2 Kings chapter 11, verse 1, it says, now when Athaliah, now who's that? She's the one who's married, she's Ahab's daughter. The mother of Ahaziah saw that her son was dead. So he's dead, and actually her husband's dead too. People are dropping like flies up here. She arose, and what does it say that she did? She destroyed the entire royal family. So now what do we do? There's a puzzle going on here. Now don't read ahead. I'm setting you up a little bit. So just, I want to be honest, preacher. There's more to come. But this is the way it looks like in the land. Because while the land is evil, while they're worshiping idols, while all those sorts of things are happening, there's still people that believe in God. There's still people that understand what has been prophesied. There's still people that are aware of the covenant that God has made. And what does this look like? The royal family has been destroyed. It looks like these people, after all this commitment to God, after all this following after Him, it looks like God's not a God who can come through on His promises. It looks like He's not a God who's going to be able to bring the Messiah, because the line of David, this Davidic covenant, it's been removed because this woman, who's not from the line of David, she's from the line of Ahab, has destroyed the royal family. And this is all in verse 1. This is in verse 1. So you can imagine, I mean, maybe in our setting, maybe it's something like this. So, you know, politics can always divide. So you might have a father in a home and a son in a home, and the son is kind of taking a different political persuasion from his father. And there's an argument going on. I can't believe you would vote for this person. Do you think this is okay? What about this? How can you be a Christian and think these things? And you can imagine the stress of something like that. Maybe you've experienced it. So surely at some point of the people who want to be followers of God and trust in the promise of the Messiah, surely as they see their royal line wiped off and as they see that there's no way that this Davidic promise can hold true, there's arguments about that. Of somebody being like, I can't believe this happened. I can't believe this happened. We put all our stock in this and it's wiped out like that. Where's the God who's in control? Now, maybe you can imagine that when it first hits their news media, whatever their social media looked like, there's probably actually people socially speaking with each other. They're discussing what's happened. Maybe there's this holdout of like, maybe they missed somebody. Or maybe whenever these brothers up here got captured, maybe there's still someone like in hiding that's going to reveal themselves. Surely there's this remnant that thinks this is going to work out. I'm going to tell you what happens a little bit in the text. This goes on for 7 years. They don't know the answer to this riddle that I'm going to give you in just a minute. For 7 years. Think what you were doing in 2010. Think what you were doing in 2010. And living in uncertainty for 7 years. So surely this conversation, this dad and this son about, oh, is God the God who says who he says he is? Is God a God who can fulfill his covenant? Is God the God who's going to come through for us with the Messiah? Surely there's some fights of like, oh yeah, I was okay with it for a week. Your crazy theories as the father's talking to the son or the son's talking to the father. I'm okay with him for a week. I was okay with him for a month. I was sort of theoretically okay with it for a year. But it's been 5 years now. 5 years. Nobody's shown up. The throne has been changed. This land is in chaos. Where's the God that you still believe in that's going to come through? He can't come through because the Davidic covenant, it's been broken. The royal family is gone. Living in verse one, and I'll speed it up. We got a lot of verses to go in case anybody's nervous. There might be somebody here, though, who in your life, you're living in verse one as well. And what I mean by living in verse one is there's some issue in your life. There's some sin in your life. There's some relational thing in your life that you trusted God with that he can use this for his good and for his glory, maybe for the first week, the first month. You still had some stamina at year one, but maybe it's like 5 years in for you. And it's like living in verse one. God's not working how I thought he would work. Is God really in this? Should I keep praying for this person that I've been praying for year after year after year? I mean, it's been 5 years. It's been 6 years. And nothing that I can see has happened. God, I don't know. I don't see you at work. So maybe I'm going to slack off and not be as concerned about it or not trust your promises as much. And that's what I mean by there might be somebody here who's living in verse one. And what this passage this morning is going to show us is we have a God who's faithful. Even when we can't see him at work, he's a God who's faithful over and over and over and over again. So that's verse one. Like I said, we'll pick it up a little bit. So, here we are. That happens in verse one. Verse two, Jehosheba, so that's her, the sister of Ahaziah who died, the daughter of King Joram, so the author's explaining who this person is, sister of Ahaziah, she took Joash. So this is the part that the country doesn't know about. And this is the part I was just getting to. Joash is actually not dead. So sorry for tricking you. Hope you'll still pay attention. Joash, who's not dead. I feel like Christmas Carol, Tiny Tim, who did not die. This is Joash as you read the text. She took Joash, the son of Ahaziah, stole him away from among the king's sons who were being put to death, and she put him and his nurse in a bedroom. Thus they hid from Athaliah so that he was not put to death. And he remained with her for 6 years, hidden in the house of the Lord, while Athaliah reigned over the land. Again, just feel the weight of that for just a little bit, because I think a lot of this passage hinges on that. 7 years ago, that's 2010. I have to think about like what I was doing in 2010 to wait that long. But, verse 4, in the seventh year, Jehoiada sent out and brought the captains of the Karites and of the guards and had them come to him in the house of the Lord. And he made a covenant with them, and put them under oath in the house of the Lord, and he showed them the king's son. So, this guy, Jehoiada, he's the leader of the priests, and he's actually married to Jehosheba. It's her husband, and he's a priest. And so what he's doing is he's saying, okay, it's been 7 years, now this king is going to be known in the land. Now the king's going to be known in the land. And you can imagine, if you're this lady, Athalia, she's not going to be happy about this. And so what he does now is he sets up his guard. He sets up the guards that are going to be around this situation where they're going to coronate this guy as king. Now the next part is confusing. And whenever I looked at the commentaries this week, they're like, the Hebrew here is really difficult. So in each translation, you're going to get something a little bit funny. So as I read it, you might have something that's very different. But basically what he's saying is we're going to set up these guards around here, and it's going to be an official looking thing. So picking it up in verse 5, he commanded them, this is the thing that you shall do. One third of you, those who come off duty on the Sabbath and guard the king's house, another third being at the gate, sir, and a third at the gate behind the guards, shall guard the palace. And the two divisions of you, which come on duty in force on the Sabbath and guard the house of the Lord on behalf of the king, shall surround the king, each with his weapons in his hands, and whoever approaches the ranks is to be put to death. Be with the king, and when he goes out and when he comes in. All right, so if I lost anybody there, basically you got a picture. There's a whole bunch of guards around this place. It's a big deal. So you can imagine you've probably driven by a house and there's all sorts of police and stuff outside. And you're kind of wondering, I'd really like to know what's going on there, but I kind of want to keep my distance too. Or you drive by, like there's a car pulled over and there's like four cop cars around it. And you're like, I'm really interested in what's going on there, but I don't want to get caught staring. This is what's going on in this text. Because this is their city that they're in, and there's all sorts of military people around there. Like it's very unusual, very unusual. And so I imagine they're feeling that same thing as they observe what's going on. Verse 9, the captains, they did according to all that Jehoiada the priest commanded. And they each brought his men who were to go off duty on the Sabbath with those who were to come on duty on the Sabbath, and they came to Jehoiada the priest. And the priest, he gave to the captains the spears and the shield that had been King David's, which were of the house of the Lord. So I don't think that's because they need more weapons in their arsenal. I think there's something symbolic going on there. I think they're saying like, okay, we're back. We're anointing this guy king. He's from this line of David. So I think there's something that is symbolic that's going on in them handing them the weapons of King David. Verse 11, the guards stood, every man with his weapons in his hand, from the south side of the house to the north side of the house, around the altar and the house on behalf of the king. And then, after all this is going on, he brought out the king's son and put the crown on him and gave him the testimony, which is the Old Testament law. And they proclaimed him king, and they anointed him, and they clapped their hands, and they said, long live the king, long live the king. And the line of David, it's back in action here in the country of Israel. Now, this is good news to almost everybody, in a way. It's not so much good news for Athalia. And now we're going to hear about what happens with her. Verse 13, when she heard the noise of the guard and of the people, she went into the house of the Lord to the people. And when she looked, there was the king. Now remember, you're picturing a seven-year-old. I thought about bringing a seven-year-old in here from Sunday school so you could see what this scene would look like. He's standing by the pillar according to the custom, and the captains and the trumpeters beside the king, and all the people of the land were rejoicing and blowing trumpets, but not Athalia. She tore her clothes and she cried, treason, treason. Well, that didn't work out so good for her. Nobody's listening to her. Verse 15, Jehoiada, the priest, commanded the captains who were set over the army, bring her out between the ranks and put to death with the sword anyone who follows her. For the priest said, let her not be put to death in the house of the Lord. So they laid hands on her, and she went through the horse's entrance to the king's house, and there she was put to death. She was put to death. And now what comes up next is just a really good shining moment in a book, 1 and 2 Kings, where there's not a ton of really shining moments. Jehoiada made a covenant between the Lord and the king and the people that they should be the Lord's people, and also between the king and the people. I think he's reminding of them of the covenant that's already been made to them. They're renewing it. They're reminding themselves of it. They're recommitting themselves to this covenant that we want to do what God wants us to do. That pushes them into action in verse 18. And it says, then all the people of the land, they went out to the house of Baal. The house of Baal, that's idols. And they tore it down, his images and the altars. They broke it into pieces, and they killed Matan, the priest of Baal, before the altars. And the priest posted watchmen over the house of the Lord. And he took the captains, the Karites, the guards, and all the people of the land, and they brought the king down from the house of the Lord, marching him through the gate of the guards to the king's house. And he took his seat on the throne of the kings. So all the people of the land rejoiced, and the city was quiet. It's a really good thing. The city was quiet after Athaliah had been put to death with the sword at the king's house. Jehoash was 7 years old when he began to reign. That's Joash. You might have a footnote. This is where I'm telling you they changed the spellings. It's not even fair sometimes. The Joash was 7 years old when he began to reign. And what we see here, what I think is being brought out through this story in the Old Testament, is we have a God who is faithful. We have a God who is faithful. Even when we can't see him in action, he's got a plan, and he's up to something, and he's doing something good, and he's a secure God. You know, we're insecure people. If people don't know what we're doing, we want to tell them. We want them to know about it. God's perfect. God's perfect in every way. And there's a security to where he doesn't always have to tell us everything that he's doing in the world. He doesn't always have to tell us everything that he's doing in our lives. But we can be confident that he's faithful to the things that he said he will be faithful about. And he might get to them in a roundabout way that doesn't make sense to us, that even has hardship and things that we don't like. Now, earlier in the year, my family, we took a vacation. And it was a fun time. We went over to see my brother and their new baby for a little bit, and then we came back up through Ohio and saw some different things. And if you bumped into me right after this vacation happened, I can almost guarantee you I was talking to you about the animal safari that we went on. So I still can't believe this exists. I can't believe they haven't gotten lawsuits to just shut them down. But there's a safari that you can go on in northern Ohio, to which you drive your car up to these gates. It's like Jurassic Park, but not quite as exciting. The gates open, and you drive your own vehicle in with the animals. It's crazy, and it was awesome. And you get food as you go before the gates like dramatically open. They're chain link. I'm spicing up the story. They give you food, and they want to charge you extra for food. They're making a lot of money here. But anyway, you go in with all this food, and then you can roll your windows down and feed deer, llamas, alpacas, big, huge, like bulls with enormous horns. The Highlander, if you know what the Highlander is, the Highlander. And so you're driving your car around, and I'm like, there's a huge, like, animal with enormous horns, like, bigger than the span of my hands, and they're coming up to our car, and they want to eat. There's, like, a llama sticking its head in the car, wrestling with my daughter's cup, and I have my foot on the brake and my hand in the back, like, trying to pull this food away from this llama. Another llama must have known that llama was doing it, because he wanted in my car so bad, he started eating that little rubber, like, sealant that keeps the water out. I was like honking my horn, hitting the glass, like, stop, like, what am I supposed to do? The car in front of me is not moving. They fed zebras, they fed giraffes. It's just incredible. And all the time, it's just like perfect vacation moment. It's what you want, especially when you have small kids. The two infants, they're asleep in the back, so they don't need to enjoy all this. But the two that are older, they're giggling, they're afraid, they're rolling down their window, rolling it up. They're dad, dad, dad. Virginia and I were laughing. We're just like, I cannot believe that we're experiencing this. It was this perfect vacation moment that we had together and the highlight of everybody's trip. Now, just hang with me for a minute here. How did we end up at the animal safari? Well, it actually happened by coincidence the day before, because we were in this pizza restaurant in Cleveland at just the right time to where there was this lull that the owners, a husband and wife, and their two daughters, their adult daughters, who are running this pizza place, have enough time to talk to us, and they get interested in the fact that we have twins, and we just hit it off like we're old friends in this bizarre way. And they're like, you're on vacation, you have to go to the animal safari. And I was like, okay, okay. And they're like, no, listen. When we were growing up, this was our favorite thing. Guess what you get to do? You get to drive through, and you get all the animals come up, and you feed them, and this and that and this and that. So we're like, okay, we'll go to the animal safari the next day. How did we end up at the pizza place? Well, we ended up at the pizza place because it's next door to a restaurant that you eat and you play board games while you eat your food, which we hyped up to our family a ton. We're like, there's this crazy restaurant in Cleveland that we're going to go to after we go to the aquarium, and you can play board games while you eat your food. You get to pick them off the wall. So our kids are hyped up for this. We get there, and it's like a hipster's nightclub or something. There's a cover charge to get in. And it's ridiculous. I'm like, you can buy like four board games for the price of our entrance in here, and I haven't bought food yet. That only made sense to myself. My kids don't get it. They're like, yeah, but there's Candyland, Dad. We can play Candyland and eat a $5 peanut butter and jelly sandwich. So we were there. My daughter, when she finds out Dad's too cheap to pay for this, she's like crying, like, no, Dad, you said we could eat at this. And so I'm like in my head trying to figure it out. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? And next door, there's this pizza restaurant, which we ended up at there. Now, if you can handle just a little bit more of this story, how did we end up at the restaurant with the board games, with the hipsters playing their dice games for $25 a person? Well, we're driving on our way to Cleveland because our main thing that we're going to do there is go to this aquarium. And we get just like in the suburbs of Cleveland, and the alarm system goes off for my son and his little bladder, where he either never has to go to the bathroom or it's an absolute emergency. And he's like, "Dad, I have to go to the bathroom right now, right now, right now, pull over." I'm like, I can't, there's no exits. So we get to the next exit, we pull off, it's suburbia, Cleveland, surely there's a gas station. I get off and I drive, and there's no gas station. And dads, I think, this is stereotyping, on vacation you kind of lose your mind sometimes, and it's like, no, I'm not turning around, there is a gas station on this road, doggone it, and we're going to find it. So we end up like miles down this road, he gets to the bathroom, and get back in the car, and I'm like, there's no way I'm going back that way, that's backtracking, we're going to go this other way, there's got to be an on-ramp, and there's not. So I take the most scenic route through suburbia Cleveland that you can possibly imagine, which means we're at a different time to the aquarium, different time to the board game place, different time to the pizza place, where we're able to have a lull in the restaurant to talk to the owners to end up at our favorite part of the vacation. So our favorite part of the vacation is traced back to my son who can't control his bladder. Isn't that interesting? Now, I want to play all that off as a joke, and in a way it is, but I'm nerdy enough in my theology and the way I look at life. I really think God's in those little moments. I know it's a silly example, but what if I'm complaining the whole time, which I was a little bit about the bathroom break, but complaining like, okay, we didn't get to do this, and we're late to this, and the restaurant that we want to go to, oh man, it's no good. This is just ruined, and missed this opportunity and the way that God had set us up to have our favorite moment on our vacation. I think God's in all that. But on a more serious note, if he's in stuff like that, surely he's in all these other moments of our life. The moments of our life where we're as an adult version of getting to the board game restaurant, it doesn't work out how we want it to work out. Maybe the job doesn't work out how we want to. Or the relationship between your parents or your children or your spouse. We end up in these situations that are just like, I've gotten myself so hyped up for this, I know exactly what it should look like. It should look like me sitting there with my sandwich, rolling the dice on this game, and we get there, and it just doesn't work out how we want it to work out. Can we trust that if we go with what God is doing, even if we can't see it, even if we can't totally understand it, that he might have something good for us? He might have something good for us the next day, the next week. It might be a year out. It might be 5 years. It might be 7 years out. You might not see it in your entire life. But isn't God, the God that we believe that created the world, isn't he great enough to be at work in our lives, even if we can't see him working, even if you're stuck in the verse one of your life? See, that's the God that I believe the Bible portrays. It shows a God who is always working. And so many times, in story after story, the people, the characters there, they don't know what God's doing. They don't know. But they're called to trust. They're called to have a relationship with God. They're called to be in the communities that they're in. And through all those different mechanisms and more, God can work miracles for his glory. And you'll experience things that you would have never expected or imagined that you could experience. See, we have a faithful God who delivers on the things that he's promised. That is in great contrast to us. We are an unfaithful people. We're an unfaithful people that need a faithful God. And when you move into chapter 12, unfortunately, sort of, we see an example of unfaithful people. And it starts right off the bat. Chapter 12, verse 1. In the seventh year of Jehu, Joash began to reign. He reigned about 40 years in Jerusalem. That's a long time for some of these kings. Talks about his mother. In verse 2, it says, he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord all his days, because Jehoiada the priest instructed him. Now, when you look at the course of his life in Kings and in Chronicles, I think the key phrase there is when Jehoiada the priest instructed him. As long as Jehoiada was alive, he did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. When Jehoiada died, Joash kind of crashes and burns, so much so that the priest and his wife, they have a child named Zechariah, and Joash has that son killed. So he ends up not good at the end of his life. Nonetheless, verse 3, the high places were not taken away. The high places were not taken away, and the people continued to sacrifice and make offerings in the high places. The high places have showed up a little bit in Samuel and Kings, and they're going to show up with more frequency in Kings. Anytime you see it, they're not following God. They're worshiping their idols in their own way again and again. So right off the bat, you see the people, they're being unfaithful to God. The next thing we're going to see is Joash, he gives the priest instructions about the temple, of how he wants it built up. And then look in verse 6, that by the 23rd year of King Jehoash, the priest had made no repairs on the house. They hadn't done what they're supposed to do either. So the priests are shown as they're unfaithful as well. They're not doing what they're supposed to do. So Jehoiada the priest, he comes up with this plan. He's going to get this box. He drills a hole in it, and they're going to put their money in it, and they're going to use this money in a particular way to build the temple back up and to provide for the priests and everything. And so they go through with this, and they do it. And there's verse after verse that talks about how they're building up the temple, how they're building up their finances. So Jehoiada is the only kind of like admirable character here. Everybody else shows their unfaithfulness. They build up the temple. Look what happens in verse 17. The king of Syria, Hazael, he went up and he fought against Gath and he took it. Now news travels fast about this type of thing. So he's getting ready to go to Jerusalem. Joash, king of Judah, he took all the sacred gifts of who? Jehoshaphat, his great grandfather. Jehoram, his grandfather. Ahaziah, his father, and all the gold that he found, had dedicated in his own sacred gifts, and all the gold that was found in the treasuries of the house of the Lord and of the king's house, and he sent these to Hazael, the king of Syria. Then Hazael went away from Jerusalem. You see, the guy gets scared. He gets scared, and he's like, here, I'll fix this. I'll get ourselves out of this situation. He's paying the money to get into the board game place. He's like, I'm not trusting God on this thing. And in fact, what I'm going to do, I'm going to get rid of all the sacred things that I've put in that house. My father, my grandfather, my great grandfather, all the money that we've accumulated from this plan that we just were put in place because I'm scared and I'm afraid of this, of losing my life. And you see, we have an example of the king not doing a good job. So we have the people, we have the priest, we have the king, and even the king's servants. In verse 19, it says, the rest of the acts of Joash and all that he did, aren't they written in the book of the Chronicles and the kings of Judah? His servants arose and made a conspiracy and struck him down in the house of Milo on the way that goes down to Selah. See, there's real treason. Athaliah, she called out treason whenever it really wasn't. And now there really is in the house. And you have this picture of these people. And it's in great contrast to that little phrase I called our attention to in chapter 11, verse 20. The city was quiet. The city was quiet, everything was good, and at some point in all that, they looped back around, and they're like, well, things are okay, we'll worship our idols, we'll worship the things we want to do, and it looped back to, it's just chaos again. It's chaos. Can you imagine them, like, frantically going through and taking all their treasures? Like, we got to get it off, because we're going to get attacked, we're going to get killed. What happens whenever their king is assassinated? They're not going to be describing their city as a place of peace and a place of quiet and a place of rest. And it brings my mind back to before the era of kings, you have the era of judges. And if you've ever read Judges, there's this such an obvious cycle that takes place in that book. The people, they get in some sort of situation and they're upset and they're just like, oh God, we need you, we need you, we need you. We're sorry for what we did, we need you. And God sends them a judge. The judge, he goes through his different ways and he fixes the land and then they get back to peace. They're like, oh yeah, life's good. We love God. And it takes them like this long. And then they start worshiping other gods. They get into all sorts of trouble. And the cycle continues. And it continues. And it continues. And in a way, it represents our lives too. Like, we're that way. We get out of trouble and everything's happy in life. And we're like, oh yeah, I love God for a little bit. And then things get easy and good and we get back into our other habits and our idols and our fears. And then we get in trouble again. And then we cry out to God. God, help us, help us. See, they're not, these people aren't so far away from us. Unfaithful people. They need a faithful God. And I think part of the key to breaking out of that loop is understanding who God is. And specific to our passage this morning, a God who is faithful. A God who's faithful. And he'll do the things that he promises. And he'll provide the type of help that he says he will. And there's the rewards of peace and joy, even in times of trials, that he says is there and available for us. But there's this loop that we need to get out of. But here's a beautiful, beautiful thing about what we believe in the Bible. It's that this faithful God, he looks down on unfaithful people and he says, I love you guys. I love you guys. I want to offer forgiveness for your unfaithfulness. And I'm going to do things that you don't even deserve of grace and mercy. And this has been characteristic of God for a long, long time. All of eternity, actually. But you know, you can see it in stories like in Egypt. The Israelites are enslaved. They're enslaved, and Pharaoh puts out an order that he's going to kill all the babies in the land. So there's a lot of weeping at that time as they go through and they do this massacre. But there's this one lady. What she does is she creates this little like basket that's floatable, and she puts her baby in it, puts it in the river. And guess what? Someone from the family, from the house that gave that order to execute all the children, finds that basket. And she takes a liking to this baby, and it turns out that the mom gets to watch the baby, and this baby grows up in the house of Pharaoh. He grows up to look a lot like Charlton Heston, perhaps. We don't know that for sure. Moses. And what does Moses do? This one baby, in this land where there had to be despair, there's no way that there wasn't despair in the land when all those children's lives were taken. There's no way. There's people who are going to be living in the first verse, like I talked about earlier. The first verse saying, where's God in all this? Where's God in this? I can't see him. How could he possibly do something good in a time like this? And yet the very one who was saved is able to take them out of the land of Egypt with Pharaoh and his armies hot on their heels. And he's so powerful before God and with God's power, he's able to raise up his staff and the Red Sea is divided. And these people who have been oppressed were part of the most miraculous, well-known story in the history of the world as they walk through on dry land, the Red Sea. And over, God shows up for them because of this person, this Moses, who led them. See, all the babies weren't wiped out. The future hope wasn't wiped out. There was one who's going to live. And so then you have this Davidic line all the way down, until it does come time for this Christmas story, and it's not ruined. The baby's born. But you know what happens after the baby's born is Herod's not happy about this, so he decides he's going to kill all the babies and the young children that are 2 years old and younger. Again, just this promises of God holding on by a thread. But what? A dream comes to Joseph, and they take Jesus and they get out of there. But again, weeping in the land. What's going on? How can this be? How can this be? Nobody knowing that the promised one, the Messiah, was growing up to be a young boy away from there, and he's going to be brought back in. So then he's brought back in. The king is there. And he's getting older. And they bring him into the town on a donkey with the palm branches in front of him. The king is coming. He's going to get his ordination and sit on the throne. That's what people think. He goes to his throne. His throne isn't what people picture. Made of two pieces of wood. And he's nailed to it. His hands and his feet. Instead of sitting there, he has to push up on the nails on his feet so that he can get air to his lungs so that he doesn't suffocate. That's what happens on the cross, which is where our king ended up. And again, he could have been in that first verse mentality of like, what is this, this isn't right. But what does he do with that air that he puts in his lungs as he struggles there on the cross? Out of his mouth comes the words, Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. That's on his heart. Because he knows the Father. He knows the Father has plans for this world that we can't comprehend. And he trusts his Father, that his Father is going to do this in the right way. And in fact, he's prayed about it in the garden. Father, if it's at all possible, remove this cup from me. It wasn't possible because God wanted him to endure that so that he could get the glory, so that people like you and I could put our faith and our trust in him, have a relationship with him for all of eternity. So he dies on the cross. It's finished. The sky goes black. And now instead of stories of young people's lives being taken, the Savior, the Messiah, his life has been taken. What has happened? Instead of it being days and years, it's one day. It's 2 days. And on that third day, empty tomb. Empty tomb. Guess what? Death has been defeated. Life has been given to people. Sins have been paid for. Sins have been atoned for. They don't need any more of a sacrificial system because the ultimate sacrifice had come and died on the cross for the sins of people so that we could have a relationship with God the Father who knew how he was orchestrating this for all of time. See, our faithful God, he understands what's going on in this world even when we have no idea. When we can't comprehend how God could be working through something like that, he works through it because he's faithful to unfaithful people like you and like me. He doesn't give up on the people who sometimes give up on him. So I encourage you, if you have something in your life, you're like, I don't see how God's at work here. I've been praying for my child for this many years, and nothing's happened. Don't give up. Keep praying for that child. Keep praying for that parent. I have this situation in my family or at my workplace, and I have no idea how God could do anything, and it's gone on and on and on and on and on. Stay faithful to God. He'll work, and he'll do things that you may never know. You may never know, or you may find out about it 10 years from then and look back and be like, yeah, God, you're amazing. You're amazing. I wasn't going to end on this story, but I'm going to. And in our small group, God's blessed us with everyone in our church who's getting close to the senior citizen discount at the restaurants. So our small group, we're like, oh, do the small group meals. And it's been great. It's been great. And so we've been joking about that a little bit, or I have been giving them a hard time about the age of the other people at the table. One thing that's come up early on in our meetings is a few different people have had these stories of whenever they were in high school, just kids that either picked on them or just in like horrible life situations to the point of like, are they suicidal? I'm not joking about that. And then both of these people that shared had stories of years and years and years later, because of something like Facebook, being able to be in contact with them and them saying, I'm so glad you treated me this way, even when I didn't treat you that way. I'm so glad you looked out for me, even when nobody else was. And I know you're a Christian, and I think in both of those stories, the person had become a believer by other means. And I think that's a good testimony. It's been an encouragement hearing those stories in our small group that don't give up on people. Keep praying for them. Keep praying for them. I have people in my prayer list that I'll probably never see again. And every time they come up, I'm like, I should probably just delete them. They're like, no, I'm going to keep praying for them. You never know what's going to happen. So I'm going to leave you with that thought. God is a faithful God. We're unfaithful people. He still loves us. And so we should more and more get to know this faithful God, follow after him, be empowered by him, live by that example of what he's done for us as we live out our lives. And don't give up on the fact that God is at work, and be faithful in the things that God has called you to do. Would you pray with me? Well, thank you that we can pray to a faithful God, a God who, even when we think we know what you're doing, I can be confident, and I feel confident that you actually have done hundreds of other things through those moments. And so, Lord, help us in our trust to grow in understanding that, yeah, time after time after time, you've shown yourself faithful. You'll continue to be faithful throughout all of eternity. And help us to live with those thoughts in our lives. Help the people that are really facing difficult situations in our church to have the endurance and the trust and the community around them so that they can persevere. In your name I pray. Amen.